Welcome to this breaking news edition of the MMA After Hour. It is Tuesday, April 24th, 2012. A crazy day in the world of mixed martial arts. And we have welcomed back our good friend Ben Foulkes to help make sense of it all. Ben, before we get into the news from Brazil to Nevada and everywhere in between, I understand you are back from your week-long vacation in Germany, and I must say, I must thank you for the series of tweets that you sent out over the past week, because they were as exciting as when my grandparents used to go away on vacation and show me slides of their trip. It was just fantastic. From beginning to end, I thank you.
Yeah, no, I took about 6 hours of video while walking around Hamburg. I'm sure you're going to want to see that. I'm just waiting for a chance for us to get together. Completely unedited footage, too, of just me walking around making hilarious observations about things I see with no historical or cultural background whatsoever. I think you're really going to enjoy it.
I cannot wait. And I also must say that, you know, you have officially overcome your suspension. You served it quite, I must say, with a lot of grace and class, although you did have a few shots in there throughout the whole process. But I should say that you did appear on the After Hour during the suspension process, and thus we will wait to fully address your MMA Hour ban the next time you officially appear on the real MMA Hour show on Monday, probably next week. You were obviously in transit on Monday, so you couldn't appear on the show. But I just want to say, in case people are wondering why we aren't addressing it, that's the reason.
Well, you know, now I feel kind of foolish. After watching Overeem's hearing, I wish, you know, I would have fought that suspension, perhaps with a attorney who seemed to be just kind of making up what he was saying as he went along. Maybe with a doctor with a shady history. I feel like I really could have got that suspension knocked down from 10 weeks to at least 7 or something. But I guess you'll live and learn.
Well, consider this me granting you a continuance and giving you a few more days to think about the horrible thing that you did to us 10 or so weeks ago. Okay, let's talk about the real news at hand here, and let's work our way backwards. The Nevada State Athletic Commission announced just moments ago that they have denied Alistair Overeem a license to fight in their state, which obviously means that the UFC will not be using him. Unless they cut him, it means that we won't be seeing Alistair Overeem fight for 9 months. They didn't go with the traditional year where he can reapply for a license. They went with 9 months, and that, of course, means that he can only reapply for a license to fight in Nevada and probably in any other state in the United States and in North America, any province in Canada, because they will all most probably you know, respect the Nevada State Athletic Commission's ruling. Let's start with that ruling. Are you happy with it? Do you think they made the right call? And if not, what could they have done differently?
You know, I'm not really sure what justified knocking it down from, as you said, they usually do a year with these kind of things, to 9 months. I mean, they made clear over and over again, members of the commission did, how much they seemed to like Alistair Overeem as a person and how weirdly impressed they were with that defense that his team offered, which I found was just the opposite of impressive. You know, he brings a doctor who doesn't really want to answer these direct questions about what he told the fighter about what was in these injections he's giving him. He has an attorney who's trying to make a case based on how entertained people were by Alistair Overeem's fight, and therefore, you know, maybe he should catch a break. I don't see how you hear that argument and think, okay, that's convincing. We should cut him some slack here. I don't understand that. I mean, I guess I'm glad to see the Nevada State Athletic Commission getting a little harder on some of this stuff and saying, hey, we're not going to just be bullied around by fighters coming in saying, even though I have my doctor and our case ready, I want a continuance, just because you know, they forced them to have this hearing today. Go ahead, get it over with, which I think was the right move. But I'm not sure I understand what they heard there that they thought was even somewhat convincing.
Now, what did you think of Overeem's case? And obviously you mentioned his doctor, Dr. Molina, which now, as he has sort of you know, had the spotlight on him, all these news stories coming up about his questionable past, and then he had his lawyer in attendance who was trying to sort of you know, paint this picture that Alistair was pulling out of the fight voluntarily because he wanted to do the right thing here. And by the way, the UFC has yet to confirm that. It didn't seem, at least to me, the way Dana White presented it at the UFC 145 post-fight press conference, that Overeem was the one that, you know, pulled out of the fight. It was more the UFC right. just sort of, you know, doing what they had to do and do what's best for business and put Frank Mir in there. But what did you think of his whole case from, you know, getting the shot on January 12th, you know, done by Mr. or Dr. Molina in Dallas, to not knowing what was in the mixture, all that stuff. I mean, what did you think of what he said out there?
You know, I'm not sure what would be worse, if he and his doctor were both lying about, hey, we had this mixture and Alistair didn't know what was in it and didn't think to ask, you know, even though knowing that he still owed the Nevada State Athletic Commission a couple random drug tests. You'd think anytime you get a syringe out for that guy, he's going to want to know exactly what's in there. I don't know if that's worse or, you know, if it's worse that they're just totally lying about this, because both of them just present so many other questions that aren't answered and cannot be answered in the easy way. I mean, either you were willfully ignorant about what you were putting in your body, or, you know, you're trying to snow us with this same defense of, yeah, I didn't know what was in there. You know, some guy gave me some stuff and I just took it and found out later, whoops, I got in trouble for it. It's amazing to me how many times pro athletes think they can trot out that same excuse, and it never really works for anybody. And yet they keep going back to it. Can you imagine if regular people did this? If regular people, so, you know, every time you failed a drug test for work or for a job application or something, it was always because, you know, yeah, you went to get a sandwich at the local deli and you didn't realize there was weed in there. I mean, that's just preposterous. And they keep coming back to it. I can't understand how they think anybody is buying that. It's just one of those things that you can say, and it's almost like it's, you know, it's kind of like the no comment thing when somebody is confronted with something that they did. We are going to assume that you're guilty when you bring that up, and yet it's a way for you to get past it without having to, you know, make any kind of admission. I don't find it convincing at all, and I think especially the way when the doctor was kind of pressed on it, his inability to just say whether or not he had told Alistair Overeem what was in there, you could tell. I mean, that's a person who is clearly not being honest with you and is trying to figure out what is the best way for him to be dishonest with you.
And the amazing thing is that we're just regular schlubs. I mean, these guys, their body is their church. I mean, they're tested. You know, Alistair keeps saying that he's the most tested athlete in sports. This is their job to be in good health, to try to do, you know, what's right, to play by the rules. And at the end of the day, if you do play by the rules, you'll get title shots, you'll get the big purses. And that's why I have just a hard time believing that they don't know what they put in their body. And of course, as you mentioned, we've heard this so many times. So now at this point, I mean, we haven't heard anything from the UFC. They had a few officials in attendance, just to sort of clear up that they didn't tip Alistair off. And let's also mention, this whole day started really badly for Alistair when Keith Kaiser, the executive director of the Nevada State Athletic Commission, said that Alistair essentially, at least in his mind, tried to sort of escape from the press conference without right. taking the drug test. I mean, that does not
sped paint, away. I believe was
sped
how
away. That does not paint a very good picture. If you're the UFC and Dana White has not been, you know, he's been supportive of Alistair when he was not part of the organization, but he's always sort of been a little hesitant to, you know, put him in the top five and all that talk. What do you do with him at this point?
You know, that's the tough question. I don't know if you can really cut him because it's not consistent with what they've done with other fighters who are in similar situations. I mean, you'd basically be cutting him because he screwed up a big fight, you know, made you lose a big fight. When that situation came up with Nate Marquardt, where they cut him for, you know, essentially the same thing, then Dana White's defense was, hey, this was not this guy's first mistake. You know, he's made a couple of these kind of things. And, you know, people want to talk about a second chance. This is more like a third or fourth chance. With Overeem, even though that suspicion has hovered around him, you know, this is the first time he's really been in that situation, been and failed a drug test and been in that seat. So I don't know if you really can justify cutting the guy that first time when you give other people, I mean, look how many chances Chris Lieben seems to get. You know, I guess it's the right move to keep him around, but also, they're going to have to be very careful of how they push him from here on out, and what cards they want to put him on, because you always know, you know, now you're wondering if there's a chance you're going to lose him again. I think in that way, you know, the punishment is going to be more ongoing. It's not going to be just the 9-month suspension. I mean, that people will look back at everything he's done, and that there will always be those doubts and those asterisks in people's minds. So I do think that the UFC should keep him around, should give him another chance. But at the same time, that there's going to be a healthy suspicion that follows him around for the rest of his career. And I don't know if fighters always realize how much that can and will hurt your legacy. I think they think that they can just say, hey, it's over and I forgot about it and I don't want to answer questions about it, and everybody else is going to do the same. People are not going to forget this.
There's two sort of amazing subplots, I think, in all of this. And the first is how big of a nightmare I think the purchase of Strikeforce has been for the UFC. If you consider all that they've had to deal with, which they wouldn't have had to deal with had they not purchased Strikeforce, from Chris Cyborg's positive test to Muhammad Lawal's to all the drama with Nick Diaz to all the questions about Gilbert Melendez and all that drama with Showtime to now this issue. And the funny thing is that they would always sort of, you know, quietly be like, well, look at this guy, look at over him, look at that, and look how he looks. And now it's their problem after just one fight. And then the other thing is that Alistair Overeem was on the cusp of really becoming a big star here in the United States. He finally made it over here. He beat their biggest draw in Brock Lesnar. He was about to fight for the title, and he had a shot to win it. And now, obviously, he's not going to get that shot. So it's just amazing when you think of this sort of perfect storm of the past, really, year and a half for the UFC. When you consider all of that, then, you know, what happened with Diaz and GSP not getting that fight, the Chael Anderson fight not taking place in Brazil. I mean, so many things have gone wrong for them. It's pretty amazing, right?
Well, I mean, with the Strikeforce stuff, it's kind of a hindsight is 20/20. Yeah, sure, I mean, there's no way that the UFC could have been like, I don't know if we should buy Strikeforce. There's no way you would see these problems coming. And you're right. I mean, maybe the Nick Diaz problem you should have seen coming. But he's worth, I think, that risk. People like him enough. People really want to see him fight enough that even if you knew that he was going to be that much of a headache, you still got to take the chance and try and make it work. And you're right, though, that maybe it's a kind of a consequence of when you sit in that big chair and you consolidate all the big MMA power in one spot. You know, if a big organization is a headache to begin with, then a huge organization is going to be an even bigger headache. Maybe that just makes sense. Maybe one thing follows from the next. I do think that some of the problems that they found themselves with after taking some of the Strikeforce guys on the roster and all these drug tests suddenly start popping up, that I think is a big motivator to now drug test everybody as soon as they have a Zuffa contract of any kind. But again, you know, and Dana talked about this at the presser at the event in Sweden, where he more or less begged us to stop pressing him on Overeem questions because he felt like he was going to lose it. And you could see that he was genuinely concerned that if he started talking about it, he might not be able to stop himself and might not be fully in control of what he said. But when he makes that case that, hey, you know, we're testing guys now that as soon as they sign a contract or test them before they go on the Ultimate Fighter, we're doing all that stuff. What else do you want us to do? Well, any drug testing where the athlete knows it's coming is essentially worthless. If he has any brain cells at all, he can figure out how to beat that. That's why you need random out of competition testing, you know, surprise him with it. That's the only kind of drug testing that's going to work. And I think that this Overeem situation, if anything, proves that. When Overeem has been tested in the past, when he can see it coming and he knows, all right, here's when I'm going to be tested, you know, he's never had a problem. It's when somebody shows up and says, by the way, pee in this cup right now, suddenly he has a problem. That should tell us something.
Are you giving Alistair the benefit of the doubt at all? Like, is it possible that he really didn't know anything about what this doctor was putting in him? He didn't know about this doctor's history, all that stuff? Or at this point, is it just hard to buy that?
If he didn't know, then it's because he didn't want to know. It's because he wanted that plausible deniability. Well, which to me does not make you innocent at all. It just, you know, you're trying to find a loophole so that you can say, I didn't know, without officially being a liar. There's no way I believe, though, that Alistair Overeem's, that this is completely genuine and completely innocent, that he goes in and says, oh, you know, I'm having some problem with my rib, I need an anti-inflammatory, and the doctor thinks to himself, you know what, I'll throw a little testosterone in there and just give it a little kick. No need to talk it over with him. By the way, you know, here you go, take this syringe, and Overeem just says, cool, I'll go ahead and inject this into my body and I won't think about it. That's completely implausible. If he didn't say, hey, what's in this, it's because he knew he probably didn't want to hear the answer.
And let's just say the final thing on Overeem, what do you think this does for his legacy at this point? I mean, is it, like you said, there was always that sort of, you know, there was that sort of doubt about him and those whispers. And up until this point, he did beat it, and he did pass all those tests. But the first time he's presented with a random drug test, at least for the first time since that whole mess in December or November, I should say, when he left the country to help his mom, and that was a big mess of a situation, and they gave him the conditional license. How do you paint the Alistair Overeem picture at this point?
And I'm glad you brought that up because that is I think when you combine all that kind of stuff, the sum of the parts there is very damning, I think, for him. That it's not just that there's this one thing. It's this all this, there's already the suspicion around a lot of weight gain, getting, suddenly huge. Then, he every time that there's a random drug test, something weird happens. He finds a way to dodge it. And offers at least a semi-plausible excuse, and then the next time there's a random drug test, he fails it. I mean, I think that the problem is when the questions started surrounding his weight gain and his just physical transformation, then now that he's caught doing something, people are going to think, well, he was doing it all along. We were right to suspect him. Now we just finally have the proof. And this is not, I don't think that there's a whole lot of people out there who are thinking, this is the first time Alistair Overeem used something. They're just thinking it's the first time he got caught using something. And this kind of thing is not going to go away. I mean, if say he comes back, say he eventually becomes the UFC heavyweight champion and has, a really successful title reign that lasts for several years, do you think that people are more or less likely to then remember and bring back up, his failed steroid test or his failed drug test, his kind of problems surrounding that whole issue? I mean, they're just going to think that he got better at beating the system. Few people are going to think that, he's totally clean. That kind of stuff just doesn't go away. And I think that's the kind of thing that's going to follow him, no matter how many drug tests he passed from here on out. People are not going to forget that. And I think that is the punishment that is most befitting the crime. Meaning, athletic commissions can fine you and suspend you, but hey, you wait that out. You write the check. What you don't, you can't get clean is the way people look at you.
And by the way, if in fact he did not know what was in that anti-inflammatory that he took, if in fact the doctor didn't tell him that there was any testosterone there, that it, obviously would mess up his levels, I hope he sues that doctor. And I think if he does sue that doctor, that would then send a very big message. If he doesn't, it also sends a different kind of message, right?
If this doctor cooked up some testosterone for you, gave you a shot but didn't tell you anything about what was in it, then he's a horrible doctor, and you should absolutely pursue a legal remedy against him. If you don't, then we all know what the situation is. You're exactly right about that. And when the more we learn about this doctor, the more it seems like what happened is Overeem found himself a doctor who would play ball. That's exactly what this situation looks like. If he doesn't do something, to try and seek some kind of legal recourse against him, then I think that will, in many people's minds, just be confirmation.
And I have to say, overall, this is probably not a very good day for the UFC because just a couple hours earlier in Rio de Janeiro, UFC President Dana White, Chael Sonnen, and Anderson Silva were at a press conference to announce that the highly anticipated Chael Sonnen versus Anderson Silva 2 rematch, Anderson Silva versus Chael Sonnen 2 and rematch would kind of be redundant.
Redundant,
Yes.
yes.
Anyhow, I'm so excited about the fight that I said it twice. But the fight that was very much very highly anticipated in it was supposed to take place in Brazil at a soccer stadium, 60,000 or so people, now has been moved to Las Vegas, July 7th. UFC 148 is now a stacked card, but this cannot be a good day for the UFC because that was going to be one of their greatest moments ever, one of the most anticipated fights in their history. Outdoor soccer stadium. I mean, it just had it all. Plus, the Chael and what he said about Brazil and all that. That can't be a good moment for the UFC that they had to move that. And by the way, the second time in approximately 6 months or so that they've had to move a fight. They were supposed to have a fight in Montreal March 24th. They had to sort of postpone it, I guess you can say, because they couldn't come up with a main event. And then the majority of that card went to the UFC 145 card. This hasn't happened often to them, and now it happens with arguably their biggest fight ever. Not a good moment, right?
No, and I blame the UN.
Yeah.
The UN with its comp first, first they dropped the ball in Syria, and now this.
Yes.
This is some real League of Nations kind of stuff. It's just going to collapse any minute, I'm sure. But no, that is got to be just a rough series of, and Dana kind of went off on this when at the Sweden post-fight presser, when we kind of pushed him on, why don't you guys do some of your own drug testing in that regard? Why don't you do your own random testing? If only to find out, you know, or at least to try and use that threat to keep these guys honest so that you don't lose main events and lose a bunch of money. You know, you can talk about the cost of doing your own random drug testing, but what's the cost of this Overeem situation? What's the cost of losing that? You know, so, and one of his arguments was, hey, I'm really busy. Do you have any idea all these places I'm going? And he is. I mean, we all know that. He is insanely busy. He's down there in Brazil. He's popping back here. He's got all this stuff to deal with. There are, you know, headaches every single day that come with this. At the same time, I mean, that's I guess, going to be part of the business. I don't know what you do about that. The UFC does have a kind of a hard time in the last couple of weeks with some of that stuff. And now you lose the big fight in Brazil. That was going to be the biggest fight in the history of Earth combat or whatever. You know, it's still going to be a great fight, but man, it really would have been something if you could do it in that soccer stadium. But hey, at least you get the sense that they did everything they could. They tried to make it happen, just couldn't make it work there. It's not like it's not going to be a big fight still, even in Las Vegas. It's just not going to have that same, you know, iconic feel of 60,000 people or whatever it is in a soccer stadium chanting for Chael Sonnen's blood.
It's not often, though, that you get to put together such a big fight where the city is a sort of player in the storyline,
right?
The country, I should say. Why not, in your opinion, why not just wait? Like, do you think they're making a mistake? Why not just postpone it for a couple months, do it in July or August or September, give everyone more time, and then just pull it off then?
Yeah, you know, I kind of think of the Rumble in the Jungle when, and that was another situation where, you know, with Ali and Foreman, where the place played such a big part in, you know, what the fight itself. And that was definitely not easy. And that was, there were thoughts, there were at least fears that after a delay that they might lose it altogether and the whole thing would fall apart and, you know, come back to Vegas or Madison Square Garden or something. But they, you know, they stayed after that one and they got it done. Maybe, you know, the UFC could learn something from that. Maybe they just looked at the reality of the situation and figured it's better to just kind of go ahead and try and get it over with, try and do it while people are still talking about it and while the iron is still hot there. I don't know. I don't know everything that went into that. Obviously, I think we all would have liked to see that fight in a huge soccer stadium in Brazil, but maybe it's safer for Chael Sonnen this way.
If you're Anderson Silva, how pissed off are you right now?
You know, I definitely feel like I got screwed a little bit, and you kind of get that vibe from him at the press conference today. He did not seem totally pleased with how that whole situation had gone down. And you can't blame him. I mean, that would have been, you know, his big kind of George St. Pierre in front of the Canadian crowd moment, and he doesn't really get that now. I mean, he got to beat up Yushin Okami in front of the Rio crowd. That was nice, but in order to, you know, to take on the guy who had criticized Brazil so heavily, criticized Anderson, his family, and all that stuff on home soil, that would have been amazing. And you know, I think you can't fault the UFC too much. They tried to make it happen, tried to give that to him, but it just didn't come together.
All right, so now UFC 148 has Chael versus Anderson 2, the rematch. Uriah Faber versus Dominic Cruz 3. Michael Bisping versus Tim Boach. Kung Lee versus Rich Franklin. And yes, Tito Ortiz versus Forrest Griffin 3. Plus other great fights like Hennen Burrell's on the fight and Damian Maia is making his 170-pound debut. My question to you is, is this lineup better than UFC 100?
Well, I mean, if you got Forrest Griffin, Tito Ortiz 3, yeah. I mean, I think that obviously that's the fight everybody wanted to see, right?
Right.
You know, I don't know. I don't know if it's better than UFC 100. That one had definitely a different kind of feel around it. Maybe we'll have to wait. I mean, when you look at it on paper, there's definitely that same kind of feeling of like every single one of these fights seems like you know, one that you would pay for on its own. And to put them all together like that does create that huge, big kind of summer blockbuster feel that the UFC has been kind of consistently working on. I don't know if it's bigger than UFC 100, but it definitely does have, you know, it's close. It's up there. And even when you look at the fights like the Dominic Cruz, Uriah Faber fight, the kind that, you know, sometimes the little guys tend to float under the radar a little bit, and they might get stuck on a cable TV fight card, even if it's a title fight. Not this time. This, you know, you get so many big, huge kind of stories coming to a conclusion all at the same time. I mean, that does feel special, and you kind of get used to the UFC having that big, you know, summer blowout. I like it.
Remember when there used to be like a UFC 42, and then 8 months later, it'd be like 43. Now, like, it feels like John Jones's fight happened 6 years ago. with all that has happened here today. It's a real fascinating time to be covering MMA and to be a fan of the sport. And the news cycle continues to change almost on a minute by minute basis. It's unbelievable. Today, one of the most newsworthy days in recent UFC history, with their biggest fight having to move locations, and one of their biggest stars denied of his license to fight in Nevada, having to sit on the sidelines now for 9 months. Retroactive March 27th, that's when the drug test took place in Las Vegas, and I guess 9 months from now would be around December or so. So we won't be seeing Alistair Overeem for at least the next few months, and definitely maybe not for for the entire year, which is obviously a big shame. Ben, any closing comments before we let you go? And probably you'll pretend to write some sort of article and wax poetic on all of this.
I will say this about the UFC 145, the John Jones fight, all that you mentioned. I was in Germany for that, so I got to experience it the way our European friends often get to experience it.
Ah, yes.
Which is watching it for free online and waking up at 4 a.m. to do so, which was not as miserable as I thought it was going to be. But it's a completely different kind of viewing experience, one that I recommend that everybody get to experience at least once. You know, you wake up super early, it feels just entirely weird. But then you watch it online. The UFC really has. I haven't watched a fight online in years. At least watched a whole fight card like that online. They've refined that viewing experience to where it's actually really solid right now. You kind of get to flip between corners and cameras on your own. So in case you get tired of hearing Rogan and Goldberg go off about how awesome Chael Mills is, you know, you can kind of opt out of that every once in a while, but it was actually a really kind of great experience. And then, you know, it's over and you can go eat breakfast. So anybody has a chance to do that while they're traveling or in any kind of situation like that, I highly recommend it. It's good to know how the other half lives, and those are some dedicated fight fans doing that regularly.
Just out of curiosity though, how did you watch it for free?
It was free on UFC.tv in Germany.
Really?
Yeah.
That is unbelievable.
I think they realized that it's one thing to ask people to wake up at 4 a.m. It's another thing to ask people to pay for the privilege of waking up at 4 a.m.
That's true.
You know, it said that, you know, some countries it was blacked out depending on what the TV deal was around there. In Germany, however, and I was told that you can, you know, wake up later if you want and watch the delayed kind of broadcast or something. But of course, you know, the internet and its ability to sneak spoilers into your life, I chose to wake up there and see what that's all about, and I weirdly enjoyed it.
All right, well, good to know. Thanks for that, and great work. Are you going to be putting out any articles about either Overeem or Chael versus Anderson 2 being moved?
Yes, I'm working on something about the Overeem thing.
All right, we look forward to that. He is Ben Foulkes. I am Ariel Helwani. This has been another breaking news edition of the MMA After Hour. Thanks so much for listening.